You drink coffee, I drink coffee, just about everyone drinks coffee. So why bother with anything but the best? Darren's coffee is roasted at his new shop in Claremont, Indiana. And coming soon, you can order on Amazon and support the show by using Scott Horton's affiliate link. Darren'sCoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives and sign up for the podcast feeds and everything at libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. All right, introducing Con Hallinan from Foreign Policy in Focus, and we reprint a lot of what he writes at antiwar.com as well, because we got a good deal with FPIF to do so. A global nuclear winter, avoiding the unthinkable in India and Pakistan. As Donald Trump ascends to the White House, he's wading into the most dangerous conflict on the globe. Welcome back, Con. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott. And you?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate you joining us today. Listen, what in the world makes India, Pakistan the most dangerous conflict on the globe? Why, don't you know there are other conflicts going on?
There are other conflicts going on, but this is a conflict between two nuclear powers who are in the midst of a major nuclear arms race, and who the leaders in both countries talk very loosely about the business of using nuclear weapons. The specific thing that got me to write this article was that recently the Pakistani military made a decision to deploy tactical nuclear weapons, battlefield nuclear weapons, and to say that they intend to use them if there's a conflict with India. Well, since the Indians don't have battlefield nuclear weapons, they don't have tactical nuclear weapons, they only have strategic nuclear weapons, if the Pakistanis use tactical nuclear weapons, the Indians are going to respond with strategic nuclear weapons, the big ones, and the Pakistanis are going to respond in kind, and there's going to be a real possibility of a nuclear war that will not only kill at least 20 million people in both India and Pakistan, but will also deeply damage the ozone layer over the northern hemisphere and produce an enormous cloud of smoke that could lower temperatures worldwide. I mean, it would make, for instance, growing wheat in places like Canada and Russia impossible. So you would have a worldwide food crisis. And nobody's talking about this. I mean, it just doesn't get into anyone's radar. And right now, it is, not just in my opinion, in the opinion of a lot of people, it's the single most dangerous place on the globe. And the United States has much to answer for the current situation.
All right. Well, let's get back to that in just one sec here. Because that's a very important point, and we have a future coming up, too, we got to talk about in terms of America's role as well. But so back to this thing about the Pakistanis developing these tactical nuclear weapons. I mean, it makes sense on the face of it, right, if their army, their land army is far overmatched by the
Indians. Yeah, the Indian army is a little bit more than twice as big as the Pakistani army.
But so on the other hand, as you're saying, yeah, but if you guys use even one, you know they're going to have to nuke back. And then that means, I think I've read, you know, not just are the Pakistanis developing these tactical nukes, but the Indians are now developing hydrogen bombs.
Yes, they are.
Nuclear weapons.
Yeah. As to whether they actually have one functioning at this point, we don't know, because those facilities are closed to international inspection. Yeah. But we do know that they're attempting to build a thermonuclear weapon.
Now, see, I never taught math at MIT or anything like that. I'm not really an expert at game theory and this and that. But it sounds like what you're talking about isn't even calculus, as a horrible people in Washington, D.C. call it. It's just simple arithmetic. If you guys use tactical nukes, they are going to use at least really big A-bombs, if not H-bombs, to wipe your cities and your civilization off of the face of the earth. And so seems like kind of the height of irresponsibility. Is there any kind of other counter argument that we're leaving out as to why they're pursuing this anyway, when it's so obvious how terribly destructive this could be? One false move and everybody dies. Why put themselves on the line like that when they weren't necessarily in that position before, even though the Indians already did have nibs?
That's a really good question, Scott. And I'm not sure that I've ever heard a really good answer to it. I mean, partly it is that most of the Indian and Pakistani population, the polls that have been taken of Indians and Pakistanis, indicate an enormous ignorance about the power of nuclear weapons. You know, it's a long time since nuclear weapons have been used.
Yeah.
You know, the last time was 1945.
Yeah, I remember in 1998 when they tested them. I saw footage on I don't know if it was CNN or what, but it was a Pakistani general saying, "You tell those Indians, we're not afraid of their atom bombs." I was like, yeah, well, somebody needs to explain to this guy that your relative level of fear of the enemy's atomic bombs doesn't really affect the function of those atomic bombs
exactly.
at all.
Yeah.
They'll still turn you to not even dust, pal.
I mean, that's what's kind of amazing is the way that people talk about this. You know, the former Indian defense minister, you know, said that they could easily destroy India. The Pakistanis have talked about that. One of the former head of the Pakistani military said, well, you know, you could die crossing the street. You're going to die at some point anyhow. What difference does it make how you die?
Oh, nice.
Yeah, which is an indication of people really not paying attention.
It's really been since Mao Zedong that somebody who actually was in the authority to do in the position to do something about
yes.
it, talk like that about civilian casualties on
yes.
their own side, right?
Yes, and the thing is, what we really are talking about is it would be an incredible tragedy for not just Pakistan and India, because of course there would be an enormous amount of fallout. So all of the countries in the region would be deeply affected by nuclear fallout. But the whole question of nuclear winter is just not been talked about. And the studies on nuclear winter have been really, you know, this is not over-the-top stuff. This is pretty straightforward. And they have a good base on which to do it, because what they base it on is what happens when you have these huge, big volcanic eruptions like Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. The effect of Mount Pinatubo was that it lowered world temperatures about 1.5 degrees. Well, they know how much, you know, ash Mount Pinatubo put into the atmosphere. They know how much ash will be created if cities are destroyed, and the Indians, you know, that's about the only, their weapons are really basically city killers. They're not tactical nuclear weapons. How much, you know, soot and smoke and everything will be there. And it's a pretty straightforward formula. And we're in trouble. On top of which, one of the things that radiation does is that radiation destroys the ozone layer. And that means that you have an enormous influx of very, very powerful ultraviolet radiation, which is not only dangerous, of course, to people because you get skin cancer and everything like that, but also kills plants. And there may be places that are as much as 70% of the ozone layer would be destroyed in the case of a war like that. And nobody's really talking about it. I mean, everybody's talking about Russian hacking.
The few people who are talking about it, though, are saying the same thing as you, though, that, hey, you know, we kind of underestimated this before. We always just think of nuclear war as between the U.S. and the Soviet Union
right.
and end all of mankind and that kind of thing. But a tiny little bitty old nuclear war in Central Asia would be enough to, as you say, at the very least, disrupt the ecosystems around the world. We got 7 billion people dependent on not too much disruption in any given year. You know, you just can't have that.
No, and if you take a look at both sides now, both sides have in excess of 100 nuclear weapons, and right now Pakistanis are moving very rapidly towards 200 nuclear weapons. Eventually, they're going to pass Britain as the major nuclear power. And you know, again, the other thing that one of the reasons I think why we don't talk about this certainly in this country is that both the Bush and the Obama administration bear a major responsibility for the current crisis, both in terms of the danger of nuclear weapons and in terms of the issue that Pakistan and India are fighting about, which is Kashmir.
Right. And now, so here's the thing about that is I was reading my buddy Eric Margulies and talking with him a little bit about it, and he was explaining that, you know, the Kashmiris, they're not really Indians or Pakistanis, which Pakistan is really kind of four different countries held together by a military anyway, but and who knows how many countries India really is. I have no idea. But he was saying that Kashmir really is its own independent land with its own
absolutely.
Its own real, you know, and that's how the old world is divided up more or less, is by ethnic groupings, and that they're pretty much their own people, and it's one of those just completely intractable problems where if I don't screw it up here, the Indians rule it, but the population is Muslim and much more, you know, lean much more toward Pakistan, and the Pakistanis refuse to acknowledge.
Most of the polls, I agree with you. Most of the polls show that if there was a referendum at this point, the Kashmiris would vote for independence. And there was,
but regardless, the Pakistanis want it anyway, whether the people of Kashmir want that or not, right?
Right. And in 1947, when Pakistan and India were divided, and there was, you know, there was a terrible tragedy, and there were millions of people killed on both sides when that happened. At that time, the UN promised Kashmir that it would have the right to a referendum, and that was blocked by the Indians. Indians blocked it. Then the Pakistani military began infiltrating terrorists into Kashmir, and it became a military situation. And essentially, Kashmir has been under is essentially under martial law, and has been that way since 1949, which is part of the problem. I mean, the big protests that are going on right now in Kashmir really don't per se have to do with the autonomy question, although that's where they want to go eventually. But it's an absolute exhaustion with decades and decades and decades of military rule, and particularly this law called the Special Powers Act, which was originally designed for Northern Ireland in 1925 to keep the Northern Irish Catholics in their place. And the Special Powers Act is what the Indians use in Kashmir. And essentially, it's a law which says that you don't have to do anything. If the authorities decide that they think that you might be having bad thoughts, they can arrest you. They don't have to charge you. They can put you in jail. They can keep you there for a year, and then they can continue to keep you there year after year after year with no charges, no proof. And the other thing is, it makes the Indian police forces and the paramilitary forces in the military immune from both Indian law and Pakistani law. So it's a military occupation with complete impunity for the occupiers, and it's just produced a level of rage that is the basis really of the demonstrations that's going on right now.
I find it kind of ironic that
you know, it starts in Ireland, right?
Yeah,
it's the same law that the Israelis use in the occupied territories. It was the same law that was used as the basis for the apartheid legislation in South Africa. It was the ultimate colonial law. And all these post-colonial countries decided, well, you know, it's not a bad law if you want to keep in power. And so they kept it.
Mm-hmm. I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
And so then the people of Kashmir basically live like Palestinians under Indian rule or what?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there have been, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of them that have been disappeared. The current demonstrations are really awful because the Indians have been using birdshot in these shotguns, and there are these people what they call dead eyes, and what they are is they're people with birdshot in their eyes, and there have been more than 1,000 people that have been blinded in these demonstrations by the Indian troops. The heavy-handedness of the Indians is just really a scandal. And the major reason for that is because they are completely immune to any laws. They can do whatever they want.
And
so here you have this situation where the native Kashmiris are demonstrating, asking for the end of the Special Powers Act, for more autonomy, and for eventually the right to have a referendum. The Indians claim that all the agitation is the result of a Pakistani, infiltration, which isn't true in this case. I mean, I think there was a good deal to say for that in the 1980s, but it's not the case in this case. And so then it becomes between Pakistan and India, which, of course, nobody's paying any attention to the Kashmiris. So for the first time now, some Pakistanis infiltrated across the border, and they killed a bunch of Indian soldiers, 9 Indian soldiers. For the first time, the Indians crossed the border into Pakistan and announced that they were doing so, and attacked what they called as a terrorist base. It's not clear what it was. There was some Pakistani military killed. There certainly is close coordination between the militants in Pakistan and the Pakistani army. I mean, we know this. It's a longstanding thing. But here's the problem. The problem is that the Pakistanis are saying that if India invades, they're not going to be able to stop the Indian army. They're still going to use tactical nuclear weapons. And then you and I are in trouble, Scott, and we live a long way from India and Pakistan.
Yeah, a lot of other people in even worse trouble.
All right,
All right, now, of course, everything in the world is America's fault here. No point in pretending it ain't. Explain to me about what India's, well, for that matter, India and Pakistan's role are in their relationship with the world empire here.
Well,
both satellites of ours in a sense, aren't they?
Yeah, what happened, what started this off, the current situation started off, was that the Bush administration back in 2003 decided that they wanted to, China from a strategic competitor to a strategic opponent. That was a formal kind of thing they went through. And they began to set up a series of alliances that were aimed at containing China. Well, the jewel in the crown was India. If they could get India to move away from its traditional position of neutrality and to join an alliance with the Americans against the Chinese, that would be an enormous plus, because 80% of China's energy supplies go across the Indian Ocean and in Indonesia, South China Sea, etc. So if India could essentially be part of an American alliance, that would be a big thing. Now, the Indians and the Chinese have their own issues, and they fought a border war in 1962, and the Indians are still not happy about that, and they claim that the Chinese are occupying Indian territory, and I think they have a certain justification for at least part of that. In any case, what happened was India said, well, what do we get in return? So what the Bush administration said was, okay, if you don't sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, and neither Pakistan nor India signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, you cannot buy uranium supplies on the international market. That's not a problem for Pakistan. They've got a lot of native uranium. It's a major problem for India. They have very little uranium. And they have a nuclear power industry. So the Indians have always had to try to somehow keep their meager supplies between both their nuclear power industry and their nuclear weapons industry. So what the Bush administration said is, look, we'll waive the part about you being able to buy uranium on the international market as long as you promise it will only be used for civilian purposes. The Indians were more than willing to do that because then they could take their other supplies and direct them totally.
Well, and the Bushes, this was a wink and a nudge thing anyway, right?
Absolutely a wink and a nod.
Even George W. Bush understands that uranium is fungible.
And the other thing is, so Pakistan, and they said, no, you can't have the same deal. Now, this is what they call a 1-2-3 agreement, is what it was called. Now, my hope was when the Obama administration came in that they would back away from this because it's a severe, I mean, it basically knocks the props out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, and you really don't want to do that. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement is one of the most important agreements on the international control of nuclear weapons. And in general, you know, it's worked pretty well. It's true that you've got India and Pakistan and North Korea that have nuclear weapons, but there are a lot of other countries that could have built nuclear weapons very easily. They didn't do so. So the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement really has worked fairly well. This just removes the central props from it. And one of the things that Pakistan said was, look, this is going to start a nuclear arms race in Asia. It absolutely has. The Indians have gone on a tear to build nuclear weapons. The Pakistanis have gone on a tear to build nuclear weapons. China, because it fears that most of those strategic nuclear weapons by India are directed at China, they're on a tear, building more nuclear weapons and putting multiple warheads on their mobile ICBMs. And North Korea is building nuclear weapons. So here you had this decision by the Bush administration and then followed through by the Obama administration, and it's been a goddamn disaster. And you now have this powder keg, except talking about nuclear weapons and powder it doesn't work. I mean, we're talking about powder, we're talking about gunpowder. Gunpowder is about as dangerous when you compare it with nuclear weapons as distilled water is to gasoline. Nuclear weapons are just in a different category of reality. And it wouldn't be hard to get something going here because tactical nuclear weapons are commanded by battlefield commanders.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. Yeah, next, they're not. They didn't just say that they were thinking about that. They have actually gone ahead and given colonels the power to use nukes if they think they need to.
That's right.
Jesus Christ.
So you've got some Pakistani colonel, you know, on the Indian border, and he's going to make a decision as to whether or not we're going to destroy 70% of the Northern Hemisphere's ozone. It's really not a place we want to be. And there should be an international full court press on stopping this, on reversing this. And it could be done. This is not an impossible situation to solve. It will require pressure on both Pakistan and India. But both Pakistan and India are countries that, certainly are subject to pressure. First of all, India couldn't be continuing this situation if it wasn't for the 1-2-3 agreement with the United States.
And our insistence that they do it, really, in order to hurt the Chinese, right?
China would be deeply affected.
But you're saying that the entire American strategy is the opposite of that because they're not even concerned about Pakistan. They're just looking at China.
That's right.
And yet, you know, the Obama administration came into power being told that, you know what was wrong with George Bush is he didn't pay any attention to Pakistan. Pakistan is everything. He spent his whole first couple of years in office, bombing the hell out of them. And, you know, you could argue, I don't know, obsessed, but certainly preoccupied with Pakistan. Pakistan on his mind, reading briefing books all night long. R. Obama. So it's kind of funny that it seems out of sight, out of mind. Or they really think that, oh, well, this is just a gamble, but it'll probably be fine?
I guess they think that. I don't know why they're thinking that. But, you know, to do anything else would be to move away from the Obama administration's Asia pivot. And that was to move the bulk of American military forces into Asia. To go from 50-50 to 60-40 in terms of military force, and to set up this alliance system, and to place these anti-missile systems in Japan and South Korea. Now, you know, the anti-missile systems, we say, well, they're there for North Korea. Personally, I think the only thing that the North Koreans are a threat to are the North Koreans. But if you're China or Russia, those anti-missile systems can be just as well as aimed at you. And so the first response to anti-missile systems is you overwhelm the system. You do it by building more warheads, more launchers, and multiple warheads on your launchers. That makes everything more dangerous. So the whole Asia pivot, the effect of the Asia pivot, has been to seriously raise the level of tension in Asia. Now, I think that the Chinese actions in the South China Sea are illegal. I mean, I think they're a violation of the international law of the sea. On the other hand, I can perfectly understand why the Chinese are doing that. I mean, to them, the pivot is it's the United States moving close to China. You know, isn't Chinese ships maneuvering off of San Francisco or Seattle or San Diego or, you know, Martha's Vineyard? It's a U.S. 7th Fleet and the U.S. 6th Fleet, et cetera, maneuvering in the Malucca Straits or off of, you know, in the South China Sea or the East China Sea, et cetera. And that was the effect of the Asia pivot. I mean, if you do this, you're going to get a response. And the thing about the Chinese is the Chinese were humiliated by the Clinton administration. In 1996-97, there was a lot of tension between mainland China and Taiwan. And the Chinese bought up a bunch of missiles, and they put them on the coast aimed at Taiwan. Now, nobody thought that the Chinese could invade Taiwan. They couldn't today. They don't have the ability to do that. I mean, it was saber-rattling. Stupid saber-rattling? I agree. Very dumb saber-rattling. But the Clinton administration put two aircraft carrier battle groups into the Taiwan Straits, and the Chinese couldn't do anything about it. They were humiliated, and they said, that's not going to happen again. And since then, they've gone on this, you know, expanding their military forces and being very aggressive about control of the East and the South China Sea. So, you know, again, I'm not supporting what the Chinese are doing in the South China Sea. I think it's illegal. But I completely understand it. And again, it really wasn't it wasn't the Chinese who started this problem. It was the United States that started this problem. And now, you know, it scares me a lot. I mean, China and the U.S. scares me, but right now the thing you ought to be scared about most of all is Pakistan and India, because we have the least amount of control, and it's the most volatile situation.
Yeah. Well, on the China thing, as long as we're on that for a minute, I wonder what you think of, for example, what David Stockman says, that China is the thinnest tissue paper tiger, that for all the fear of the rise of their economy and of their military might, that after all, they have a fascist system, which means that their economy is based on political decisions, not economic ones. And so they have horrible distortions all over the place, and so many corrections coming due that it'd be a million years before they really are a peer competitor with the United States.
I mean, I think there's truth to that, and I also think that they have an absolutely terrible sort of ecological situation. They have pollution like you just don't believe, and I don't know how they're going to move away from that, because the current Chinese government keeps in power by keeping the growth rate fairly high, and the thing about growth rate being high means you're producing a lot of stuff, and in their case that means that they're producing huge amounts of pollution, because a lot of their power still comes from coal, and they're burning that stuff. They've got and the water crisis is going to get worse.
Yeah.
They're already in conflict with a lot of other countries and things about water control. So I think that David Stockman is right to a certain extent. I think he maybe overstresses it a little bit. The fact is that China is an enormous economic power, and people are going to have to come to terms with the fact that that China is really a worldwide power. How we deal with it, it's not entirely clear, but I think the way that you deal with it is that you don't make it a military confrontation. I don't think that the Chinese military is a threat to us, and I don't think it's going to be a threat to us for a very long time. Nuclear weapons, however, certainly are a threat.
Right. Yeah, and they have just enough of those to erase, all the major cities in the western half of our country anyway.
And civilization as we know it.
Yeah.
And in my case, Scott, I'm on the West Coast. So
yeah.
We're talking about one of those cities.
Yeah. Well, I think Austin's probably in range, too.
I got four grandkids, and I just want them to, grow up and have a good life.
Well, I'm pretty sure, Austin, Texas is on that target list, too, if it comes down to it. Thanks very much, Con. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for having me, Scott.
Have a good one, man. Appreciate it.
Okay, and Merry Christmas.
You too. All right, y'all. That is Con Hallen, and you can find him at Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. And we rerun all of it at antiwar.com, too. The Global Nuclear Winter, Avoiding the Unthinkable in India and Pakistan. And that's the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Check out the archives and sign up for the podcast feed and everything at libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show, and help support. It's our end of the year fund drive. You can write it off on your taxes. It's a legit 501c3 and all of that. So deprive the IRS and the empire of your revenue stream by diverting it to us instead at libertarianinstitute.org/support. And we got lots of great kickbacks, man. I should really emphasize lots of great kickbacks, books, silver rounds, and you can enter a raffle for a 2-week stay down in the jungles of Costa Rica, down at Joshua's permaculture farm there, and take a 2-week permaculture course. And you can find out all about that at libertarianinstitute.org/support. Thanks, y'all. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I got a great deal for you. Anyone who helps support this show with a $50 donation or more gets a copy of the brand new Rothbard book, Murray N. Rothbard book, of long-lost essays from 1967 and 68. It's entitled Never a Dull Moment, A Libertarian Looks at the 60s. Murray N. Rothbard, really Mr. Libertarian himself, on Vietnam, conscription, civil rights, LBJ and Nixon, and all kinds of great stuff from back during those times. Never a dull moment. And it's an exclusive. It's not available on Amazon yet. It's an exclusive, so far at least, for listeners of this show. So be the first to get it. Help support this show at the same time. Just go to scotthorton.org/donate. And again, anyone who sends $50 on this way, along with a mailing address, and I will get this book right to you. Thanks. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.